Those strange bleeps and boosts and such like take us into another edition of the Culture Shapers, or indeed Culture Makers, where we're actually looking at the 1974 science fiction film Dark Star. And to actually comment on this and provide some additional podcast views, as ever a top soul in the wonderful world of film and television, mostly celebrated quite rightly so for his tremendous work within science fiction in the television series Doctor Who, and of course Star Cops, and heaps of other series, too many to mention. We're delighted to welcome once again Graham Harper, Ace Director and BAFTA Award winner. Graham, thank you for joining us on the Culture Shapers.
Thank you very much.
So let's consider this particular number, which in many ways is the ideal companion piece to what was screened recently, 2001 A Spaced Odyssey, because Dark Star is often billed as the Spaced Out Odyssey. In every sense of the word. And it's the total antithesis in so many ways to what Kubrick was actually doing with his mega opus 2001, really. This is the budget equivalent, but with equal interesting things about the state of mankind and so on. First question for yourself, what was it that appealed to you? Did you see it when it was first released in 1974, or did you come to love it more as the years went by?
I didn't know of this film at all until about 81 period, 1981, when I was doing the director's course at the BBC. So all those kind of things were science fiction and westerns were all on my horizon. They were the areas I wanted to go. And I was hoping one day in my life that maybe Doctor Who might come my way. You never know. And suddenly one night, whilst I was doing the course, on television, I think it was BBC Two, they announced they were going to show Dark Star. I'd never heard of it. It was John Carpenter's first, in fact it wasn't, it was his second film, but his first film, they said, which was a major feature film, that he'd made it as a student at university, and then it had been kind of upgraded and general release. So I watched this thing, and my whole world was changed regarding filmmaking, how you go about it, and what's possible, and the kind of genre, the feel of it all. And it was a delightful send-up of 2001 to me. So that's my first impression. I saw it one night in 1981, and I discovered the film that actually, I think, changed the course of history of a certain genre of film, which was science fiction films.
It was, as you rightly say, originally a student movie, or at least the screenplay was completed whilst both John Carpenter and indeed Dan O'Bannon, of whom more later, were film students at the University of Southern California. The budget was roughly around about $60,000. So a reasonable budget from that point of view, but in terms of actually what they developed and produced, for what I suppose in equivalent terms in Britain would have been around about £12,000.
Extraordinary, isn't it?
Yeah, that's that sort of thing. And they still managed to actually create this sense of, I suppose, worn-out exhaustion and tiredness. I mean, it's set in the mid-22nd century. Mankind's reached a point in technological advancement that enables colonization of the far reaches of the universe. And we're introduced to these characters, all male. I mean, it's interesting in terms of the lineup. The only female voice that we actually have is that of the computer.
Yeah.
Played by, I believe, the interesting titled named Cookie Knapp, yeah. who looked after the computer side of things. But when I first saw it, because I think, like yourself, Graham, I saw it on television before seeing it on the big screen. And initially I felt a little disappointed, because this was a science fiction movie which didn't really have any notable stars. I mean, until then, and by stars I mean hero characters,
yeah.
Whether it was the character of the captain of the starship, or obviously you mentioned Doctor Who, it was somebody who was quite clearly there, or the Gerry Anderson creations. The kind of were areas where there was clearly somebody who was put in the heroic, even if it's the hero scientist and so on, and yet here we actually had people who actually... they're all kind of somewhat dysfunctional and tired in their own way. I mean, Doolittle, the captain that we actually, the chap who actually... Second in command. We find the captain is effectively in hibernation later on with respect to Commander Powell. But Doolittle, Pinback, Boiler and Tolby, kind of, it's almost as though, well, all right, we're doing this stuff, it's a job. They're almost like the refuse collectors of the 22nd century.
Yes. I think the understanding of the film is, excuse me, is that they've been at it for 20 years. Yep. It takes 10 years now for the mission controller's voice to actually reach them, so it takes them another 10 years to say thank you very much, and these are the next lot of problems. So they're really kind of lost and having to look after themselves. They're on their own, really. Mm. That's the first thing. They don't like each other. They've even forgotten each other's first names. Tarby has ended up not wanting to be with any of the other three. He stays upstairs in a pod on the skin of the spaceship, searching for and watching out for the Phoenix... what do you call it?
Asteroids. Phoenix, the Phoenix asteroids.
Asteroids, yeah. Which are these glittering stars and diamonds and jewels that float through the air, which one day he hopes to be a part of and certainly ends up being a part of. They are, you're right, it's dysfunctional. Shall I tell you the thing that the moment that I found extraordinary, brilliantly done, and taught me a big lesson in directing for the future, and that was... Pinnock chasing after the friendly alien that they've the pet alien that they've got on board, which is in the guise of a big beach ball that's kind of sagging with badly drawn eyes that go all the way round, if I remember. And a sort
and
of mouth that doesn't ever open, obviously. And this friendly, beautiful beach ball that has these fang-like, not fangs, but talons, horrific feet. He chases after this friendly thing to get it in control because he's the only one that really likes it. And it ends up, this wonderful piece of comedy turns out to be the most horrifying, terrifying moment in the film, which is Pinhat being attacked by this this awful beach ball. That's actually thought, at one stage he crosses a lift shaft with a huge piece of metal, a flat metal that he can climb across, or a ladder. He climbs across, gets to the other side, the beach ball bounces back to the hole the other way, and pulls the ladder back, so now he's trapped the other side of a lift shaft. And then the beach ball attacks him. It is terrifying, but it's done with humour to start with, and while you're laughing, well, I remember feeling the comedy so brilliantly at that moment, and then suddenly this horrific thing happens. And there's a near-death kind of sequence that gets resolved by Pinnock managing to climb through a very tight hole in the bottom of the lift. There's a lift coming down at one stage and stops on his nose. Manages to climb through a hole or whatever, by releasing a panel from the underneath, and then can't get out, so he has to detonate himself out of that. So it's a really horrific, terrifying journey for this, and it lasts about 10 minutes, the whole sequence.
You're absolutely right. I mean, the other thing with respect to that, I mean, Pinback, of course, played by Dan O'Bannon, and Dan O'Bannon actually went on from that, because when he wasn't too happy with respect to what he referred to as the beach ball with claws segment, because obviously he'd wrote it, he actually sort of saw the audiences were not actually laughing at parts which he'd actually intended as humorous. He then decided, well, if he couldn't make them laugh, maybe he could make them scream. And of course, what does he do in 1979, 4 years after the Dark Star? He produces Alien, or at least writes Alien, the screenplay for Alien, directed, of course, by Ridley Scott. The same kind of thing, actually, in terms of, obviously, we don't get the sense that the alien is the mascot that's brought on board the ship, but certainly that horrific moment, and obviously that might be one of the future movies we'll be considering in terms of the culture shapers, but I thought that was quite fascinating. Also, technically, I mean, this is where it's... Yeah, from your own point of view, that elevator sequence was actually filmed by rolling about on the floor. And apparently it was a Moviola camera dolly that was used in an old USC cinema building, which used to be a horse stable, which actually sort of shows how the thing works. And it's so effective, you know, to even sort of know that. Prior to that, I suppose, classic examples in or fandom that you might be aware of was when the Adam West Batman and Robin would walk up the wall of a building, and that was obviously done on the floor, etc.
Yeah, and then turn around.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But I mean, as a filmmaker, did you sort of think, yeah, actually, it's a relatively inexpensive budget, and it's a really effective way of getting that tension. And as you said, of course, the moment where you actually get stuck in the actual lift shaft, and of course, the alien starts tickling him as well.
Yeah. Oh yes, I think the alien is an innocent. It's prodding him. It attacks.
Wants to have some fun. Wants to have some fun. Exactly.
And for fun. And then sometimes when you are, I remember as a kid, you know, when fun becomes, excuse me, that hurt more than you were meant to do. And then it gets slightly out of control and starts to get really vicious. And that's what happens. And then there's a sort of innocence at this ball, which of course gets really damaged in the end anyway. So the game's up for it. But I found it, I tell you what I found extraordinary was, Dan O'Bannon now takes that same sequence, twists it around, but quite blatantly takes the same thing and gets Harry Dean Stanton to go through the spaceship in Alien, calling out, come on, kitty, 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 and you know what's going to happen, and you're given clues of what's going to happen. This time there are no laughs. It is really, really terrifying. But it's the same thing. Him, you know, it was not this lift shaft. It's still walking through a tool workshop, as it were, on the spaceship. It's all dark and dingy with chains hanging down and whatnot, and breath from the alien. Oh, it's terrifying. He wins. He gets there in the end.
There's a really interesting part as well. We'll consider the music as well in a few moments. But
yes.
When the computer actually decides or gives the opportunity and starts playing The Barber of Seville, and we have the sound of The Barber of Seville, which in itself is a comic opera, is actually the music that effectively we played before. Of course, another musical choice is selected. And again, you know, from the computer's perspective, or from the ship's perception, it seemed they actually trying to fulfill its role as looking after the crew.
Yeah.
Little realizing that obviously we've got this thing here. And again, that triggering offer of events that sort of eventually heads to the unfortunate sort of connection of the laser. Was it just because over the 20 years these things have not been replaced? Has it sort of worked through that? Again, we're not knowing. In fact, even with Dan O'Bannon's character of Sergeant Pinback, he may not even be Sergeant Pinback at all.
Yes, you don't know. You know nothing.
Well, there is that sort of line when we have the video diaries, and what a wonderful precursor to the Big Brother video diaries. Because I think anybody who sees Dark Star cannot look at the Big Brother television series ever again without sort of thinking, well, it's exactly the same. You know, you go into a room and you actually develop with of course the big difference that you have that wonderful line about censorship. Any obscene gestures or language are effectively edited out, sort of blinked on that basis. But that's where we get the revelation that actually Pinback may indeed have been a fuel specialist called Bill Frug, who actually took the real Sergeant Pinback's place. Is that true, or is it a case of he's gone mad? He's gone space crazy.
Yes, and in the end, actually, it doesn't matter. But you are left wondering, well, who the bleeding hell is he?
Yeah.
It is extraordinary. It's an extraordinary film. Look, this film was made at film school, but before John Carpenter made that film with Dan O'Bannon, or created it and then made it, he had made a film. I have a huge affinity with this guy, and I didn't know. I loved westerns. I saw many, many westerns as a kid during the 50s. It was a huge period, a huge age. The 40s and 50s was a huge age of westerns, and in stunning Technicolor or whatever. I also loved, but not as much, the strange science fiction films that he mentions, that he loved. He was brought up on the 50s. Kind of horror films, not horror films, science fiction films, and horror, I suppose. So eventually, his father then gives him, he was a musician, so he starts off his life in a family full of music. His father gives him, because he loves, obviously, film, his father gives him a movie camera, a little small home movie camera, and an edit suite, basically, like a little Moviola or Editola or whatever. and a splicer, and he's able to edit his own films. So he has come into the film industry, no, into the film school in the University of South Carolina, California.
Easily confused, I'm sure, as Phil Leonis would say.
He comes in with all this knowledge that can be really honed and fined by going to uni and working in workshops, etc., where he's freely able to really do his learn his craft, as it were. So he's got a lot going for him before he gets into the film school. When he does, he creates a film called The Resurrection of Bronco Billy, which is his kind of gesture to a nod to his love of westerns. And it's a delightfully it's a short 10-12 minute film, I think. It won an Oscar for the best short of that year. It then was released into the cinema as well, and doesn't make millions, but makes a lot of money, and obviously gives him a lot of credit. He then makes Dark Star, which I don't know is a huge success. Over the years, it's become a fantastic cult film. Whether it made lots of money for him and those that funded the film, I have no idea. But he hoped it would be his calling card to Hollywood, that he would be allowed to make westerns, which was his dream, and it never happened. I don't think he ever made a western, which is a real shame, because I'd like to see the films he did make, and the ones that I remember seeing were fabulous. And Halloween is one of the most terrifying. I watched Mark Kermode talk about it on an interview, and he said something lovely, which was, when you see that film now, you think it's very cliched and old-fashioned, whatever. What you have to remember, it was the film that started all those cliches. It was the innovator. He was the innovator. And all that's come since has become the old hat, as it were. Mm.
You mentioned, obviously, John Carpenter there, and not a slouch in filmmaking, of course, himself. Assault on Precinct 30, the Fog.
The Fog's a brilliant movie. Yeah,
the Starman, lots of other things there. But again, in an interesting line here, looking at the first time, and you mentioned the first time things had actually worked through there, when we see the effect of the ship Dark Star going into hyperspace, it's very much the same technique that's used later, in 3 years' time, in fact, 1977, by George Lucas in Star Wars, whole Star Rush past thing, which was quite fascinating. John Carpenter has gone on record as describing Dark Star as waiting for Godot in space.
Oh, isn't that brilliant?
Can we started off this discussion by talking about how, in essence, it's a case of, well, there isn't a sort of, the narrative doesn't seem to drive a lot, although, as we've said, there are moments that kind of really do expand. Is it that sort of aspect that we sort of think, well, a bit like Samuel Beckett, who makes use of the pause and uses it so effectively, that's where we actually see things really opening?
Yes, it's like music. It's when the music's not playing that's also important as when the music is. There's lots going on in the silence, in those tacits, and I think Carpenter really knows how to do that, not in just Dark Star, but in everything he does. He has moments of not tranquility, but stillness and silence and nothingness. We compared at the beginning the film being the kind of, if you like, on speed version of 2001. Mm. Stanley Kubrick, made a very serious film about a serious look at space and space travel and how we're advancing. Our man from two or three million years ago to now is just a little puff of smoke in the air. It's nothing. That time is so small in the time of big things that we've advanced very quickly and got to where we are now really quickly, particularly in the last 200 years. He shows that. We then suffer the silence, if you like, on Dark Star. Although there's chatter and whatever, there's inane chatter. There's dialogue that means nothing really to us because we don't really know. You can't really hear what they're talking about. At one stage, Sergeant Pinnock, Dan O'Bannon, is just talking. He does it twice. He talks relentlessly over and over again about something that he's obviously said for the last 20 years every day over and over again. They're all bored to tears, sick to death. And every time they say, you've said that to us, you've been heard this, shut up. He just carries on because he doesn't listen. He doesn't hear. He just goes. That's as important as the silence. To me, that's the madness of silence, isn't it?
He has to talk.
Otherwise, what is there left? And is it of importance anyway? Well, they're great memories of Earth and what happened on Earth. We get the same sort of feeling from 2001, but that's a much more intellectualized, serious look at life and death, really, isn't it? Whereas here, we sort of take a moment in time. It's like an hour of that day, and then they all get destroyed. It's all finished, whatever. I'm spoiling this for anybody who wants to watch the film. But anyway,
people have the choice, Graham. They can download and listen to these podcasts before or after. So
that's true.
Or indeed during, in the case of Metropolis. Yeah. But hopefully not.
Well, I think not.
Clearly, again, a lot of focus on Pinback Man. There's only so many times you could obviously sort of have a comedy rubber chicken seen as amusing, or indeed eyes that pop out to actually work through that. And there is a sort of desperation sense. It's interesting, you mentioned obviously the chat, that after he's had that near-death experience, which is new, the sort of feeling is, well, so what? You know, there's almost this sense that we just have to carry on regardless.
Yes. Well, he does that himself, Dan O'Bannon, the way he plays it. He's terrified. I tell you what that film does. It makes you care, definitely for him. You care for the people on the spaceship. You wonder why they're so dysfunctional, but you sort of care for them. You're shown them in a good light, and then you're shown them in a bad light. You know, the arguments, the happiness, and then whatever they have been like to each other, I'm talking about in Dark Star now, whatever they have been like to each other, the moment a drama happens, they've got to really technically get their heads down and get on. The three of them in the little control unit are absolutely one, and they forget all their differences and get themselves out of their trouble they're in, absolutely professionally and brilliant. And I found that extraordinary, the way he covered that. And then we get back to, what are we doing here? Back to the drollness of the journey, as it were. I found that really interesting. I learned some big lessons in dramatic terms from watching that film, and have used the same kind of technique in my style. I've nicked that idea from John Carpenter. The roughness of their personalities to each other, and then the unique brilliance of how they all drop into automation as soon as they have a ship's problem to solve.
It's interesting you mentioned your own inspirations and use from that side of things. The character of Pin Backer, who appears in Danny Boyle's 2007 film Sunshine, again directly inspired by Pinback. So even Danny Boyle sort of first saying that. Of course, Sunshine, again about a space exploration. Thing. And inevitably, Doug Naylor has acknowledged the fact that without Dark Star, probably no Red Dwarf television series at all.
Absolutely. It both spawned various things like Red Dwarf and pays beautiful homage to 2001. Fun homage, but homage. It was saying, don't take yourself too seriously to Stanley Kubrick, but unfortunately I don't. Well, I'm sure Stanley Kubrick loved watching it. I'm sure if he saw Dark Star, he'd find it brilliant.
Still to come, we'll be talking about the existential bomb and how to teach a bomb phenomenology. How indeed Alan Jones, writing in Uncut magazine, uses the line, forget about 2001 and Apollo 13, Dark Star is still the best film ever made about men in space. We'll address some of the issues as well. But let's have a listen for a short while, Graham, to some of the music that we actually hear within the production. Yes. One track in particular.
Skies, your cool touch in the night. Dancing Arizona, blue warm wind through your hair. My body flies the galaxies, my heart longs to be there.
much kinder when we watch them, you and I.
By Bill Taylor and music written by John Carpenter. Benson, Arizona, of course, interesting place in terms of looking at Benson. Well, obviously we wanted to look up this particular city, and it's a city which has a population currently of just over 5,000. It's actually founded as a rail terminal 40 miles east or southeast of Tucson in Arizona, and that's part and parcel of the whole thing in terms of the rail terminal sort of structure that we've got there. But it's a song which I find myself, it's almost like an earworm, Graham, that kind of thing, which again is so completely at odds with what we've heard in the electronic tonalities. John Carpenter actually wrote the music for Benson, Arizona, and comprised the movie, the music for the film as well.
Yeah.
But again, it sort of adds to the strangeness, the strangeness, but at the same time, the equivalence of what these guys are going through.
Yes, emptiness. Middle of nowhere. What I found interesting about the music, I don't like electronic music. I mean, I'm not a great fan of Kraftwerk and all that. Yet at the same time, there are some wonderful tracks Kraftwerk have made that are unusual and brilliant. But in general, I personally don't like electronic music, certainly as background. Except when I did Doctor Who, I'm sorry I'm bringing it back to me, which is unfair.
It's why you're
about John Carpenter. When I did Doctor Who, the first story I did, which was Caves of Androzani, Roger Lim, who did the music, who was the composer from BBC, the music workshop there, he said that, well, that's all I've got. We can't afford to give you a big orchestra or whatever, but I wanted orchestral sounds. I wanted to be a big John Williams kind of thing, because that's what we were competing against. So God bless him, he got samples, and through his synthesizers, he created much more big orchestral sounds, which I thought were brilliant. He changed the style of music for Doctor Who, for that episode, for that block anyway. And I found it extraordinary how he used electronic music. And then blow me down, 8 years later, I'm talking about from Doctor Who starting. He started in 63. By 68, 69, there's this guy, John Carpenter, creating Dark Star, and guess what kind of music he uses? Synthesizer, Moog synthesizers, which obviously he's used in his musical aspirations. And suddenly, we've got a throwback, a reference back to Doctor Who. And I think his music, his electronic music, sometimes is great, and sometimes is not as good as Doctor Who, even from the 60s. Mm. I think I found that extraordinary. Was he influenced by Doctor Who? I don't think so, because I don't think Doctor Who was ever seen in America during the 60s. But it felt like he was moving it along. Does that make sense? That
absolutely.
He certainly inspired electronic music. I think the music in Dark Star is absolutely terrific.
You mentioned Kubrick, 2001 Space Odyssey. Clearly the HAL 9000 computer there has got his own fans and had his own nervous breakdown within the system. The female version of HAL 9000 that we introduced to in terms of Dark Star seems to probably be the sole form that has its act together, really. And ultimately it's not the computer's fault that actually there are problems. If only the surveys had been carried out and the people had actually done the maintenance work, then there wouldn't have been an issue. But it's thanks to the female machine that, of course, the bomb was first talked out of exploding. There was that interesting thing, which again I thought this is very, very strange. But the notion that the bomb would effectively simply be carrying out its task and have to be persuaded that no, it shouldn't explode because it was simply an error. There was a sort of, again, a weariness there, which surely presages Marvin the Paranoid Android and other creations that Douglas Adams put together within, obviously, Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy.
Yeah. Yes, John Carpenter's got a lot to answer for. You're absolutely right. It's the thing at the end where Doolittle goes and talks esoterically to a bomb that thinks it's God, and won't be deterred from it. And then he says, he makes him, the computer, with the bomb, think about, I'm sorry, I'm getting the two things confused. He makes the bomb that thinks it's God question itself. And he manages, at the last, very last second, he manages to convince the bomb to not blow up. It's extraordinary how just the idea that you can talk to a bomb and talk to a computer and have a free thinking conversation where the bomb can actually work, or computer can actually think and work out like a human being the rights and wrongs of what it's about to do. I thought that was extraordinary, an extraordinary thing. Again, it's a throwback to 2001, because the same kind of conversation is had between Hal and Dave. So they have the same kind of conversation. But here, and I don't think in Dark Star, I didn't think this was a wonderful comic moment. I thought it was a very serious moment. I took that very seriously. Of course, it is meant to be comedy and sarcastic, but it is absolutely brilliant the way it's dealt with. I'm sorry, I'm saying this very badly.
I think it's very much a case of it was considered, and in retrospect we look at it as a black comedy, but it was actually marketed originally as a serious science fiction film, and so many of the cinema going audience didn't actually expect the humour, and as a result didn't quite get that audience. But I think, you know, in times to come, obviously they have, which is why we're talking about it today. I have to mention as well with Kubrick, surely also Dr. Strangelove, or How I Learned to Love the Bomb. Again, if we look at this period of human experience, which most of us kind of lived through, or at least some of our folk will actually have a historical perspective of, you know, we're very close to thermonuclear destruction, and there is the threat of the bomb that's ever present there. And clearly, we mentioned Apollo 13, that had obviously just occurred. It did show that actually NASA itself wasn't infallible. Things could go wrong in space, and you had a situation here where, again, you have an all-male crew, obviously you have four astronauts as opposed to three. You're kind of taking up on that basis of the bomb, the concerns with the bomb. We hear from the commander, actually, the fifth member of the crew, technically, who we find out was electrocuted, unfortunately, when the ship went into hyperspace, and is kind of kept, or his consciousness is kept alive in that refrigerated cryogenic chamber.
Yep.
And his advice for Doolittle is, talk to it. Yeah. Talk to the bomb.
But he was right to. The other thing, you just mentioned Dr. Strangelove, and I hadn't given that a thought, but of course John Carpenter had, because the wonderful reference for me, I cannot remember the name of the character, but at the end of Dr. Strangelove, there's a big fat, he's a very famous actor from America, whose name has gone right out of my brain.
He actually rides the bomb.
And he rides the bomb, yelling out Geronimo, whatever, as it's being dropped on Russia. I think that's exactly the same as Doolittle surfing on a piece of debris into the atmosphere of the Earth, the planet that's about to be blown up, as it were. I found that absolutely delightful send up. What's lovely for me is that Kubrick had his tongue in cheek when he was doing Strangelove. I don't think he had his tongue in cheek when he was doing 2001. That was a much more serious look. But of course, Dark Star refers to both movies, and I hadn't thought of that. I hadn't thought of that moment in of the bomb being ridden by the big police I can't remember, he was a police sergeant, wasn't he, whatever.
I was indeed. I think we're looking at Sterling Hayden, who was the character who actually sort of wrote to that.
Yeah.
Of course, we must forget that, because there is another connection with our family here that we put together, because Shane Rimmer, of course, the voice of Scott Tracy, was also it was one of his first movies. He was one of the co-pilots in Dr. Strangelove, so a little nod to Shane Rimmer as well. Talk to the Bomb, of course, that worked first time round, and we think that there is safe there. Doolittle engages, as you said, in that philosophical conversation with Bomb Number 20, because obviously they've done 19 before that.
Yep.
The bomb decides to actually abort its countdown, retreat to the bomb bay for further consultation, and yet the fact that Doolittle has actually mistakenly taught that bomb, or perhaps not mistakenly, consciously taught the bomb Cartesian but doubt, means that the next time the bomb actually decides again that only it can exist and its sole purpose in life is to explode, it explodes, therefore it is.
Yes.
So it actually does it. And we have that classic biblical reference, let there be light.
Yes. and it's sad because both, what's his name, Boiler and Pinnock are lost forever. I mean, they've gone, and then the other two are stuck in the middle of nowhere, both going in their different directions very fast.
And we have, again, that sort of sign. We still see Commander Powell jettisoned into space encased in ice, so technically he's there. Again, you could actually argue, did we not see a similar thing happening with the astronaut Frank Poole in 2001, where effectively he's left to float away and just continue on that basis?
Yes, absolutely.
Admittedly, the sequels that Arthur C. Clarke produced, he does sort of re-emerge, I think, in Odyssey 3, 2061, but that hasn't been adapted as yet. Maybe it's something you should actually take on board as a next project, Graham. You mentioned at the start, of course, Talby finally gets his wish, he gets his dream, he actually finds the Phoenix asteroids, and they accept him. They
accept him
into them.
He drifts towards them and eventually goes involved and dies happily.
Which then leaves Doolittle, of course, to have his little touch of heaven, which is, of course, finding a piece of debris which he can look at, finally being a skateboard. So his surfer dimes from Malibu, California, which, again, we see this. I mean, again, I thought that was a fascinating thing in terms of the mise-en-scène of the film, the musical bottle organ that's actually used to actually sort of create music and various other elements. And, of course, just returning briefly to Pinback, the notion that he actually uses an 8-track cassette to effectively record his video images and so on.
In the diary room.
In the diary room.
Yes,
exactly. So, is there a favourite character that you actually have of the ones? I mean, we've talked about the Commander, Doolittle, Pinback, Boiler, the computer. Where would you actually sort of say, yes, we'd go with that one?
I like them. The one I liked, I suppose, well, I liked Pinnock because, and you really are being told most of the stories through his eyes anyway, and then it isn't. But a good 2/3 is to do with him.
Well, he did write it, so it's fair enough. I mean, that's
he did write it, the character.
I'm Sergeant Pinback. Let's go with it.
I think Talby. I quite like Talby. I like the fact that he decided he didn't like the rest of them, fed up with their arguments, and was going to go and enjoy himself peacefully in the pod. And he just watches all day and all night, well, it's all night all the time. He just watches beautiful things happening, hopefully, and sometimes he watches big explosions. I love the fact the ship can go into hyperdrive and disappear 20,000 million miles before the bomb goes off. I think that's brilliant, then goes back again somewhere else. I find that form of transport exciting. That really turned me on. Talby is my probably my favourite character.
Well, again, one of the strap lines for the movie has been bombed out in space with a spaced out bomb.
Sometimes
these marketing people, they kind of manage to actually coin a phrase, which is worthwhile. Total Film actually described Dark Star as wallowing in stone science fiction irreverence, a cult classic beyond compare. Sure.
Yes.
Intriguing for that point of view.
Well, at least you understood it. It wasn't so up its bottom that you didn't really understand what was going on. It's very clear. So for doped, if they were high on anything, I think it didn't affect the storyline.
And there was, of course, the classic line that, again, returning to 2001, that sort of notion that, you know, many reasons that people actually sort of kept going back to watch it was actually sort of, it was best seen whilst under the influence. I wouldn't sort of say that's a good way to actually work through the whole thing, but it's a fact, I think, of the time, the countercultural movement and the kind of the postscript. We haven't, of course, mentioned Vietnam, which was also sort of endemic to the whole system, which I think also gave a kind of sense of weariness, but reality. Do you feel that actually we're kind of returning now to making well-thought-out, well-crafted black comedy science fiction material? I mean, inevitably, the remake question is something we've regularly considered on these editions of the Culture Shapers and so on. And I put the same question to yourself that we've put to several directors, Ilana Rain over H.G. Wells' Things to Come, Dean Haglund over Metropolis, Phil Leonis over, 2001 and Forbidden Planet. Would you, if the opportunity came, consider a remake of Dark Star? As a director yourself?
Never. No. I think what it lacks and what it achieves is what is the film is so beautiful. The fact that it doesn't have money spent on it because it had to be cobbled together by just those two blokes, because the two of them, John and Dan, Dan did all the effects. He created and designed the shape of the effects and how they would be, and designed the set. He wrote it with John Carpenter. And when you watch it, you are shocked by some odd things that you see in this as part of the setting, but mostly you don't think about it. And in fact, by the time 5 minutes has gone by and you realize this is going to be a cheap film in terms of the way it looks, you don't think about it. You just think of the great story that's being told and how it's being told so well and played so well. Because the throwawayness of the acting, apart from the odd dramatic moments, is just everyday bananas. And I find that brilliant. There's no way you could... I can make do that probably on my own without even trying. I think that's the beauty of the film, the fact that it lacked so much money but had so much love given to it makes it what it is. You couldn't remake that.
Film is obviously a collaborative project. In most cases, it's a collaborative project. It's worthwhile mentioning the director of photography, Douglas Knapp, who I suspect was actually married or had Cookie Knapp, the voice of the computer, in terms of... So again, they're keeping their views together from that point of view. And of course, executive producer, we had Jack Harris, and associate producer, Jay Stein Kaplan, in terms of the details of the whole sequence. Especially, much, of course, for the other character we haven't talked about, the one which we didn't, and the person who actually opens the whole movie, that, of course, is Watkins,
yeah,
from Mission Control, played indeed by Miles Watkins. To sort of open up that whole sort of sequence.
It's interesting that, because there are direct cuts, even by the fact that it's the beginning of it took a little bit of while for 2001 to get going, because you had all the
the Dawn of Man.
You had that in 20 minutes,
exactly.
And then we get the movie.
Yes.
But the movie starts with, if I remember rightly, once we see where we are and what we're doing, the movie starts. Once we get onto the spaceship, it starts with the Mission Control having a conversation to Dave, and I think his father comes and has an natter to him. I can't remember now.
But it's the link that they actually have. In fact, it's the BBC interview that was actually pre-recorded, and actually they edited out the time delay system so that Dave Bowman and Frank Poole could actually watch the screenplay unfold and themselves. And equally, we had notions of when we had birthdays for Frank Poole and so on. Huh. We had that sort of time delay that was in there. So, I mean, I think both films actually accurately fulfil the sort of notion which would please Einstein, that actually the further you actually move away, the longer it actually takes for signals to actually get back in touch to Earth and so on. And there is that sense that, well, you are out on a limb,
yeah,
and sorting through with that whole process.
Yeah, and I think that John Carpenter felt that about his life as well at that moment. I'm sure he did. There's a marvellous couple of bits of trivia to talk about, which is, you mentioned Jack H. Harris, who was the executive producer. I don't know the detail, but these two people, he and John Carpenter, did not see eye to eye in the way that film should be made. And I believe that Harris was brought on to executive produce and keep an eye on these two tyrants. Not tyrants, but young ragamuffins who were obviously going to spend all the money before they'd actually put anything on the screen, whatever they thought. And these were two serious filmmakers. They might have been jokers and hippies and whatever to Jack H. Harris, but John Carpenter is a serious filmmaker and was never going to waste money and waste time. And at one point on the screen, somewhere in the chaos, you see, I won't say the word, but you see F.U. Harris come up on the screen somewhere. So I'm sure that was a direct reference to Jack, get off my back.
It's important, and after all, let's face it, if you actually look at some of Jack Harris's productions, The Evil Force, Dinosaurus, Eyes of Laura Mars, and of course the sequel to The Blob, Son of Blob, maybe we know that sometimes the suits have got the best ideas and best of intentions, but you need to actually let the artists get on with the whole thing.
There's one film there that I think was brilliant. Hello?
And would that be Eyes of Laura Mars?
Yeah, I think The Eyes of Laura Mars. Yeah, I suddenly heard a bleep bleep. Yeah. The Eyes of Laura Mars, I think, is a terrific movie.
Could well be that the computer's saying, my word, astonishingly, we've actually come to the end of another edition of the Culture Shapers and headed off into that scenario. Graham, it's been an absolute delight sharing some time with you today to actually talk about this. And obviously, if you have been listening to this, it may well be you've downloaded it as a podcast. You may be listening to it on Siren 107.3 FM. I know we're running some of these as a mini-series over the holiday season. But Graham, thank you for your time in terms of sharing some thoughts with Dark Star. Hopefully, we've brought back some memories again with respect to a movie which clearly kind of just consistently sort of shows innovation. One other thing we need to mention, of course, for comic book fans, returning, of course, to the final sequence with Lieutenant Doolittle, Brian Norell, of course, who's the actor who portrayed Doolittle. Haven't really heard a great deal about Brian Norell, I think. He's one of the sort of moved in. We must check that out. But it's clearly a reference, an homage, really, to the Stan Lee, Jack Kirby character, the Silver Surfer, created by Marvel Comics, of course, which again was very much seen as a wonderful countercultural icon. He was the herald of Galactus, the World Conqueror, and indeed the sort of person who would actually sort of surf the power cosmic with his cosmic surfboard as well. So. Even that, I think, you could see a definite sort of connection within the sequence as well.
Yeah, it spawned many.
Graham, it's been fantastic. Let's do this again sometime.
And Toby says to Doolittle, "You're my favourite." That sounds very familiar to me.
There you go.
Stars in the sky, but they seem so much kinder.